Serena Williams, which was sensational. Eventually, we watched the Washington Wizards on TV. Finally, everybody started to wander off to bed, but there were hugs and kisses first. Nice. Very nice. Much, much better than yesterday, and I was willing to bet, not as good as tomorrow. Chapter 17. About 11, I finally climbed the steep stairs to my office in the attic. I reviewed my case file on Sunrise Valley for 20 minutes or so in preparation for the next day. Then I called Jamila in San Francisco. I'd talked to her a couple of times over the past 2 days, but I'd mostly been too busy. I figured she might be home from work by now. All I got was a voice message, though. I don't like to leave messages myself, especially since I'd already left a couple from Nevada, but I finally said, "Hi, it's Alex. I'm still trying to sell you on the idea of forgiving me for what happened at the airport in San Francisco. If you want to come east sometime soon, I'm buying the plane ticket. Talk to you soon. I miss you, Jam. Bye." I hung up the phone, then let out the sigh I'd been holding in. I was blowing it again, wasn't I? Hell yes, I was. Why would I do such a thing? I went downstairs and ate a double-sized piece of cornbread that Nana had made for the next day. It didn't help. Just made me feel even worse. Guilty about my eating habits. I sat on a kitchen chair with Rosie the cat in my lap, stroking her. "You like me, right? Don't you, Rosie? I'm kind of a nice guy." The phone calls weren't over for the night. Just past midnight, I received a call from one of the agents I'd worked with out in Nevada. Fred Wade had something he thought I might find interesting. "We just got this from Fallon," he told me. "Receptionist and a best in there was raped and murdered 2 nights ago. Her body was left in the brush near the motel parking lot. Like we were supposed to find it. We got a description of a guest who could be your Colonel Schaefer. Needless to say, he's long gone from Fallon." Your Colonel Schaefer. That said it all, didn't it? He's long gone from Fallon. Of course he is. Chapter 18. I didn't sleep much that night. I think I had awful nightmares about the weasel and about the Holocaust in Sunrise Valley, Nevada. Early the next morning, I had to sign permission slips so the kids could go on a field trip to the National Aquarium in Baltimore. I signed the slips at 4:30 before they were up, and while the house was still dark, then I had to sneak off to work. I didn't get to say goodbye, and I don't like that. But I left love notes for Janny and Damon. Such a nice pops, right? I drove to work with Alicia Keys and Calvin Richardson on the CD. Good company for the trip and whatever lay ahead. These days, major threats were being run out of FBI headquarters in D.C. Since 9/11, the Bureau had shifted dramatically. From what some people felt was a reactive, investigative organization to a much more proactive and effective one. A recent addition, a $6 million software package at the Hoover Building, included a 40-million-page terrorism database dating back to the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center. We had a blizzard of information. Now it was time to see if any of it was worth a damn. About a dozen of us met on the subject of Sunrise Valley that morning in the Strategic Information and Operations Center Command on the 5th floor. The obliteration of the small town had been listed as a major threat, even though we had no way to tell whether it was. So far, we didn't have a single clue as to what Sunrise Valley was really about. There still hadn't been any contact with the bombers, not a word from them. Surreal. And probably scarier than if we had heard from them. This particular conference room was one of the jazzier, more comfortable ones. Lots of blue leather armchairs, a dark wooden table, wine-colored rug. Two flags, an American and a DOJ. Lots of crisp white shirts and striped ties around the table. I had on jeans and a navy windbreaker that read FBI Terrorism Task Force. And I felt that I was the only one dressed correctly for the day. This case sure wasn't going to be business as usual. The room was loaded with heavy hitters, though. The highest-ranking person was Burt Manning, one of the five executive assistant directors at the Bureau. Also present were senior agents from the National Joint Terrorism Task Force, as well as the top analyst from the new Office of Intelligence, which combined experts from the Bureau and the CIA. My partner for the morning was Monty Donnelly, a superior analyst and a good friend from my time at Quantico. "I see you got your personal invitation," I said as I sat down beside Monty. "Welcome to the party." "Oh, I wouldn't miss this. It's like sci-fi or something. It's so weird, Alex." "Yeah, it's all of that." On the screen at the front of the room was the special agent in charge from the Las Vegas field office. The SAC was reporting in about the mobile crime lab that had been set up inside the town limits of what had been Sunrise Valley. She didn't have much new, though, and the meeting quickly moved on to threat assessment. This was where everything got a lot more interesting. First, there was a discussion of domestic terrorist groups such as the National Alliance and the Aryan Nations. But nobody really believed those simpletons could be responsible for something as well-planned as this. Next up was the latest on Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, the radical jihad movement. These groups received a solid couple of hours of heated discussion. They were definitely suspects. Then formal assignments were given out by Manning. I didn't get an assignment, which made me wonder if I would be hearing from Director Burns soon. I didn't particularly want to hear from him on this one. I didn't want to travel out of Washington again, especially back to Nevada. And then it got really wild. Every pager in the conference room went off simultaneously. Within seconds, everybody had checked his pager, myself included. For the past several months, all terror threats got flashed to senior agents, whether it was a suspicious package on a New York subway or an anthrax threat in L.A. The message on my pager read, "Two surface-to-air missiles missing at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. Connection to Sunrise Valley situation being investigated. We'll keep informed." Chapter 19. "No rest for the righteous," read a placard on the wall near the canteen and soda machines. At 5:50 that night, we were called back to the conference room on the fifth floor. The same august group as before. Some of us were guessing that the Bureau had finally been contacted by whoever was responsible for the bombing of Sunrise Valley. Others thought this might have to do with the missile thefts from Kirtland. A few minutes later, half a dozen agents from the CIA arrived, all in suits with briefcases. Uh-oh. Then came a half dozen hitters from Homeland Security. Things were definitely getting more serious now.
"This is getting inky,"
Monty Donnelly whispered to me.
"It's one thing to talk the talk about interagency cooperation, but the CIA is really here."
I smiled over at Monty.
"You're sure in a good mood."
She shrugged.
"As General Patton used to say about the battlefield, God help me, I do love it so."
Director Burns entered the room precisely at 6. He walked in with Thomas Weir, the head of the CIA, and Stephen Bowen from Homeland Security. The three heavies looked extremely uneasy. Maybe just being there together did it, which succeeded in making all of us nervous, too. Monty and I exchanged another look. A few agents continued to talk, even as the directors took their places in front. It was the veterans' way of showing that they'd been here before. Had they? Had anyone? I didn't think so.
"Can I have your attention?" Director Burns said,
and the room immediately went quiet. All eyes were glued to the front. Burns let the quiet settle in, and then he continued.
I want to bring you up to speed. The first contact that we received on this situation was 2 days before the bombing in Sunrise Valley, Nevada. The initial message concluded with the words, "It is our hope that no one will be injured during the violence." The nature of the violence wasn't revealed or even hinted at. We were also instructed not to mention the initial contact to anyone. We were warned that if we did, there would be serious consequences, though these consequences were never spelled out for us.
Burns paused and looked around the room. He made eye contact with me, nodded, then moved on. I wondered how much he knew that the rest of us didn't, and who else was involved. The White House? I would think so.
We have been contacted every day since then. One message went to Mr. Bowen, one to Director Weir, and one to me. Until today, nothing of consequence has been revealed, but this morning each of us received a film of the bombing in Nevada. The film had been edited. I'll share it with you now.
Burns made a rapid circular hand signal, and a video began to play on the half a dozen monitors around the room. The film was in black and white. It was grainy and looked handheld, like news footage. Like war footage, actually. The room was very quiet as we watched the video. From a distance of a mile or more, one camera angle revealed the Army trucks and Jeeps arriving in Sunrise Valley. Moments later, the mystified residents were escorted from their mobile homes into the trucks. A man pulled a handgun and was shot dead in the street. Douglas Puzlowski, I knew. The convoy then drove off quickly, raising great clouds of dust. In the next shot, a large dark object tumbled into view from the sky. While it was still in the air, there was an incredible explosion. The film of the actual bombing had also been edited, but showed footage from only a single camera. The editing was mostly a series of jump cuts. Jarring, but effective. This was followed by a long shot of the explosion. The plane that delivered the bomb was never in the shot.
"They filmed the whole damn thing," Burns said. "They wanted us to know that they were there. That they are the ones who bombed the town out of existence. In a few minutes, they're going to tell us why. They'll call on the phone. The person making the calls has been using phone cards from public phones. Crude, but effective. So far, the calls have originated from grocery stores, movie theaters, bowling alleys. Pretty much untraceable, as you know."
We sat mostly in silence for a minute or two. There were only a few private conversations going on. Then the quiet was broken. The phone at the front of the room began to ring.
Chapter 20.
"This will be on speaker for everyone to hear," Burns told us. "They said it was permissible, even advisable, for all of you to be here. In other words, they expected an audience. They're very big on rules, as you'll see."
"Who the hell is they?"
Monty whispered up close to my ear.
"See? It is sci-fi. Aliens, maybe. That's my bet going in."
"We'll know in a minute, won't we? I'm not betting against you." Director Burns pushed a button on his console, and a male voice came over the speakers. The voice was heavily filtered.
"Good evening. This is the Wolf."
The hair on the back of my neck rose immediately. I knew the Wolf. I'd chased him for nearly a year. In fact, I'd never known a more ruthless killer.
"I'm the one responsible for the destruction of Sunrise Valley. I'd like to explain myself. At least, as much as you deserve to know. Or should I say, as much as I want you to know at this time."
Monty looked over at me and shook her head. She knew the Wolf, too. The news couldn't have been worse if the call had come straight from hell.
"It's good to be able to talk to all of you, So many self-important people gathered together just to listen to my ramblings. The FBI, CIA, Homeland Security. I'm so very impressed. Humbled, actually.
Do you want us to talk or listen? Burns asked.
Who am I speaking to? Who was that just now? Would you mind identifying yourself?
It's Director Burns, FBI. I'm with Director Weir of the CIA and Stephen Bowen of Homeland Security. There was a crackling sound over the speakers that might have been a laugh.
Well, I'm just so very honored again, Mr. Burns. I'd have thought you would assign a lackey to speak to me. At first, anyway. Someone like Dr. Cross. But you know, it's better that we talk top to top. That's always best, don't you think?
Weir from the CIA said, you specifically requested the first team in your earlier contact. Believe me, this is the first team. We're taking the bombing incident in Nevada seriously.
You've actually listened. I'm impressed. I've heard that about you, Mr. Weir. Although I foresee some possible problems between us in the future.
Why is that? Weir asked.
You're the CIA. Not to be trusted. Not for 1 minute. Don't you read your Graham Greene? Who else is on your first team? Stand up and be counted.
Burns went around the room, listing who was present. He omitted a couple of agents, and I wondered why.
Excellent choices, for the most part,
the wolf said once Burns had finished the roll call.
I'm sure you know who to trust and who not to, who you can depend on with your very lives. Personally, I'm not keen on the CIA, but that's just me. I find them to be liars and unnecessarily dangerous. Does anyone there disagree?
No one spoke, and the speakers crackled with the wolf's laughter.
That's interesting, don't you think? Even the CIA doesn't disagree with my scathing indictment.
Suddenly, the wolf's tone changed.
Now listen closely to what I have to tell you, you morons. That's the important thing now. You have to listen to me. Many lives can be saved if you do, and you must obey. Does everyone get that? Listen and obey. I want to hear you. Please speak up. Do all of you fucking understand?
Everyone spoke at once, and although it seemed absurd and childish, we understood that the wolf was showing us he was in control. Total control. Burns suddenly spoke in a loud voice. He's gone. He hung up. He's off the line, the son of a bitch.
Chapter 21.
We waited like his puppets in the conference room, but the Russian mobster didn't make contact again. I knew the bastard well, and I didn't expect him to call us back. He was playing with us now. Eventually, I went back to my office, and Monty Donnelly headed to Virginia. I still hadn't been assigned to the case. Not officially, anyway. But the wolf had known I would be there in the crisis room. He'd singled me out for a gratuitous insult. Just his style. What was he up to? A mobster using terror tactics? Starting a war? If a small group of madmen in the desert could do it, why not the Russian mafia? All it seemed to take was a ruthless enough leader and money. I waited and wondered if the terrible uncertainty I felt was part of the Russians' plan to increase the pressure and stress. To control us? Test our patience? And of course, I thought about Jeffrey Schaefer and how he might be connected. What was that all about? I'd already pulled up most of the recent data on Schaefer. We had put an old girlfriend of Schaefer's, his therapist, under surveillance. Her name was Elizabeth Cassidy, and I was trying to get a look at the notes from her therapy sessions with Schaefer. Later, I checked in at home and talked to Nana. She accused me of eating her cornbread, and I blamed it on Damon, which got a cackle out of her. "You have to take responsibility for your actions," she scolded. "Oh, I take full responsibility," I told her. "I ate the cornbread, and I'm glad. It was delicious." Shortly after I got off the phone, I was called down to a meeting in the crisis room. Tony Woods from the director's office addressed a room full of agents. "There have been new developments," he began in a solemn tone. "All hell is broken loose in Europe." Tony Woods paused, then went on. "There were two more terrible firebombings about an hour ago. Both were in Western Europe. One bombing took place in the northern part of England, in Northumberland, near the border with Scotland. The village of Middleton Hall, population 400 plus, is no more." Woods paused. "This time, the townspeople were not evacuated. We don't know why. There were close to 100 casualties. It was a horrible bloodbath. Whole families died, men, women, and some children. We have already received a film segment from Scotland Yard. A local policeman took it from the Cheviots, which are a range of nearby hills. I'll put it on for you to see." We sat and watched the short film in total, stunned silence. At the end, the local policeman himself spoke to the camera.
"My name is Robert Wilson, and I grew up here in Middleton Hall, which is gone. There was a single main street, a couple of pubs and shops, houses of people I knew. There used to be an old Royal Engineers bridge into town, but that was blown up. Our local pub, gone. As I stand here, looking over this wasteland, I am reminded of why I am a Christian. What I feel most is hopelessness about our world."
Following the moving tape, Tony Woods told us about the bombing that had taken place in Germany. He said he had no accompanying videotape as yet. The damage in Lübeck was not quite as horrifying, but it's bad. A group of college students apparently resisted. 11 of them were killed. Lübeck is in the Schleswig-Holstein region of Germany, near the border with Denmark. It's a farming area, secluded. The Wolf has made no contact about the bombings, nor were we warned ahead of time. All we know is, it's escalating. Chapter 22. What next? And how soon would it happen? The tension during the next waiting period was excruciating. A madman was out there blowing up small towns and wouldn't tell us why, or if the attacks would continue and get worse. For the time being, I concentrated my attention on a close study of the psychopathic weasel, reading and rereading everything in his thick file. More than I wanted to, I could see his face, hear his voice. I wanted to bring him down. I went through notes from the psychiatrist who treated Schaefer when he'd lived in Washington. Not only had Dr. Elizabeth Cassidy been Schaefer's shrink, she'd been his lover. The notes were mind-boggling, to say the least, especially given the nature of their relationship and how it had developed, and also how wrong she'd been about Schaefer. As I read, I made notes on Dr. Cassidy's notes. First encounter. Unknown year-old male, self-referred with stated chief complaint, "I'm having trouble at work focusing on my projects." Stated that what he does is classified. Also described people at work telling him that he has been behaving strangely. Clients said that he is married, father of three, twin girls and a boy. Stated that he is happy at home and with his wife. Impression. Well-dressed, very attractive, articulate male, somewhat restless and with considerable presence. Somewhat grandiose in describing his past accomplishments. Rule out, schizoaffective disorder, delusional disorder, substance-induced mood disorder, primarily alcohol or recreational drugs, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, borderline personality disorder, unipolar depression. Interview 3. 10 minutes late for appointment today. Irritable when questioned about this. Stated that he felt spectacular and yet seemed ill at ease and anxious in session. Interview 6. When questioned about home life and earlier discussion of problems with sexual functioning, became somewhat inappropriate. Chuckling, pacing, making sexually explicit jokes, and asking about my personal life. Stated that when he and his wife are together, he engages in fantasies about me and that this causes him to ejaculate prematurely. Interview 9. Quiet today, almost with flattened effect, but denied any depression. Felt that people around him don't understand me. Continued to describe sexual problems with wife. Stated that he had an episode of impotence last week with her, despite fantasizing about me. The sexual fantasies were very detailed, and he refused to curtail them when asked. Admitted to being obsessed with me. Interview 11. Marked change in affect today. Very energetic, euphoric, and almost overwhelmingly charismatic. Possibility of sociopathic disorder. Questioned the need for further sessions and stated, I feel terrific. When questioned about issues with his wife, stated, things couldn't be better. She adores me, you know. Discussed an episode of risky behavior this past week involving driving his car very fast and intentionally leading police on a high-speed chase. Alluded to participating in sexual behavior with another partner, possibly a prostitute, and spoke of rough sex. Manner of relating today was flirtatious, almost openly seductive. He is convinced that I want him. Interview 14. Missed last appointment. No call. Apologetic today, but later became angry and restless. Stated that he felt the need to reward himself. Discussed increase in libido again, mentioned calling several high-priced escort services to engage in sexual activity, and discussed desire to engage in sadomasochistic behavior. Said that he is probably in love with me. No effect when he revealed this to me. None whatsoever. I must say, I am a little speechless. Colonel Schaefer seems to be attending these sessions almost solely for the purpose of seducing me. And unfortunately, it's working.
Chapter 23.
After reading Dr. Cassidy's notes, I have to admit, I was a little speechless too. More than a little, actually. The strange case notes began to side with Schaefer after the 16th visit. They no longer contained any of his personal feelings that must have led to the affair. Then Dr. Cassidy stopped making notes on the sessions altogether. How incredibly odd, not to mention unprofessional. I assumed that their affair had begun by then. If I needed any more proof of what a clever and highly disturbed psychopath Schaefer was, I had it in Dr. Cassidy's notes. Late that night, I got a call to head down to the crisis room again. I was told that the wolf would be calling momentarily. This had to be something. The countdown had to start. When the call came through, he began in a low-key manner.
Thank you for getting together again on my behalf. I'll try not to disappoint you or waste anyone's valuable time. Directors Burns, Bowen, Weir, do you have anything you'd like to say before I begin?
You told us to listen, said Burns. We're listening. There was a burst of laughter from the wolf.
I like you, Burns. I suspect you'll be a worthy adversary. By the way, is a Mr. Mahoney there in the room?
The head of the hostage rescue team and a friend of mine glanced at Ron Burns, who nodded to him to speak. Ned Mahoney sat hunched forward in his chair, and he was giving the wolf the finger.
Yes, I'm right here. I'm listening.
He still had his middle finger extended.
What can I do for you?
You can leave now, Mr. Mahoney. I'm afraid that you won't be needed. You're too unstable for my tastes. Too dangerous. And yes, I'm quite serious.
Burns motioned for Mahoney to go.
There will be no need for the FBI's hostage rescue team. If it comes to that, all is lost, I assure you. I hope you're beginning to understand how my mind works. I don't want HRT mobilized, and I don't want any further investigation. Call off the dogs. Are you all listening? No one is to try to find out who I am or who we are. Do you really understand? Please respond if you do.
Everyone in the room called out, "Yes." They understood. Once again, it seemed that the wolf was trying to make us feel like children. Or maybe he just enjoyed humiliating the FBI, CIA, and Homeland Security.
Anyone who didn't respond just then, please leave the room. No. Sit back down. I'm just having fun at your expense. I'm what you might call a creative type. But I am serious about Mr. Mahoney and about there being no formal investigation. I'm deadly serious about it, in fact. Now then, let's get down to today's business, shall we? This is an interesting juncture, actually. I hope someone is taking notes.
There was a pause of approximately 15 seconds. Then the wolf resumed.
I want you to know the targeted cities. It's time for that. There are four, and I would advise that these cities prepare for a worst possible case scenario. The cities should prepare for total destruction.
Another pause. Then,
the targeted cities are New York, London, Washington, Frankfurt. These cities should prepare for the worst disasters in history, and not a word of this goes public, or I attack immediately.
Then he was gone again. And he still hadn't given us any deadline. Chapter 24.
The President of the United States was up at 5:30 that morning. Unfortunately, he had already been in meetings for almost 2 hours. He was on his fourth cup of black coffee. The National Security Council had been in his office since a little past 3:30. Those present included the heads of the FBI and CIA, plus several intelligence experts. Everyone was taking the wolf seriously. The president felt he was sufficiently briefed for his next challenging meeting, but he could never tell about these things, not for sure, especially when politics came into play in a real emergency situation. "Let's get this unfortunate circus started. Let's do it," he finally turned to his chief of staff. A couple of minutes later, he was talking with the German chancellor and the British prime minister. They were all on screen, all slightly out of sync in the strange land of video conferencing. The president found it a little hard to fathom, but none of the country's intelligence services had anything concrete on who the wolf was or where he might be living. He said as much to the others. "Finally, we agree on something," the German chancellor said. "Everyone is aware that he exists, but no one has a clue where he is," the Prime Minister agreed. "We think he's former KGB. We think he's in his late 40s, but all we know is that he's very clever. It's maddening." They all agreed on that single fact, and finally they agreed on one other thing. There could be no negotiations with the terrorist. Somehow, the wolf had to be hunted down and terminated with extreme prejudice.
Part 2.
Misdirections.
Misdirections.
Chapter 25.
Chapter 25.
All large cities were becoming the same boring and antiseptic place to the Wolf now, as capitalism and multinational businesses spread everywhere, and major crime followed and spread as well. The Wolf spent part of the night walking in one of the world's most important cities. It doesn't matter which one, since the Russian was equally uncomfortable in nearly all of them. But tonight, he happened to be in Washington, D.C., plotting the next steps. No one understood the Wolf, not a single person in the world. Of course, no one was ever understood by anyone else, was he? Any rational person knew that, but no one could possibly comprehend the Wolf's extraordinary level of paranoia. Something burned into his heart long ago, in Paris, of all places. Something almost physical, a poison in the system, his Achilles' heel, he suspected. And this paranoia, the certainty of an untimely death, led to a passion, not exactly a love of life, but a need to play fiercely at it, to win at all costs, or at least never to lose. So the Wolf walked the streets of downtown Washington, and he planned even more murders. Alone, always alone, frequently squeezing his black rubber handball. A good luck charm? Hardly. But ironically, a key to everything about him, the little black ball. Time to think, to plan, to execute, he reminded himself. He was sure that the governments wouldn't listen to his demands. They couldn't give in. Not yet. Not so easily. They needed another lesson. Possibly more than one lesson. And so, a late-night drive out to FBI Director Burns' home in the Washington suburbs. What a desirable life the man seemed to live with his family. The Wolf genuinely felt that way. An attractive, well-kept ranch house, modest enough, consistent with an American dream of a sort. A blue Mercury sedan in the driveway, bike rack with three two-wheelers, basketball hoop with a glass backboard and a bright white square above the rim. Should this family die? A simple enough task to execute. Pleasurable, in a way. Richly deserved. But was it the most effective lesson? The Wolf wasn't sure, so the answer was probably no. Besides, there was another target to consider, a grudge to settle. What could be better than that? Revenge, a dish best served cold, thought the Wolf, squeezing his rubber ball again and again.
Chapter 26. Welcome to the process-obsessed federal government and its completely bizarre way of doing things. That was my mantra lately, something I'd told myself nearly every time I entered the Hoover building, and never truer than during these past few days. What happened next followed the prescribed protocol under a couple of recent presidential decision directives that affected the Bureau. The response to the Wolf would fall into two distinct categories, investigation and consequence management. The FBI would oversee the investigation. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, would be in charge of consequence management. Very neat and orderly. And unworkable. In my opinion, anyway. Because the threat was to a major U.S. metropolitan area, two actually, New York City and Washington, the domestic emergency support team was deployed, and we met with them on the fifth floor of the Hoover building. I was starting to feel that I worked out of the crisis center. Still, it was anything but dull. The morning's first subject was threat assessment. On account of the three bombed towns, we were taking the terrorists seriously, of course. The discussion was led by the new deputy director of the Bureau, a man named Robert Campbell McIlvaine, Jr. The director had recently talked him out of retirement in California because he was so good at what he did. Some of the talk was about false alarms, since there had been many of them in the past couple of years. It was agreed that this wasn't a false alarm. Bob McIlvaine was certain of it, which was enough for most of us. The second topic was consequence management, so FEMA ran the session. The ability of health care providers to deal with a big blast in Washington, New York, or both cities simultaneously was called into question. The dangers of sudden evacuation were now a major issue because the sheer panic to get out of either city, but especially New York, could kill thousands. The theoretical but very frank talk that morning was the scariest I'd ever been a part of, and it got only worse. After a 30-minute lunch, for those with an appetite, and a break for phone calls, we launched into suspect assessment. Who is responsible? Is it the Wolf? The Russian mob? Could it be some other group? And what do they want? The initial list of alternatives was long, but it was quickly whittled down to Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, or possibly a freelance group operating for profit and maybe working with one of the organized terrorist units. Finally, the talk turned to action steps to be spearheaded by the Bureau. Mobile and fixed surveillance was being set up on several suspects around the United States, but also in Europe and the Middle East. We had begun a huge investigation already, one of the largest in history. All of it against the explicit and threatening orders given by the Wolf. Late that evening, I was still going over some of the most recent data that had been collected on Jeffrey Schaefer here and in Europe. Europe? I wondered. Is that where this plot is coming from? Maybe England, where Schaefer lived for so many years? Maybe even Russia? Or one of the Russian settlements inside the United States? I read a few reports about Schaefer's years working as a procurer of mercenaries in Africa. Then something hit me. When he had traveled back to England recently, he'd used a disguise. He'd gone into the country in a wheelchair. He'd apparently traveled around London using the wheelchair disguise. It was all so doubtful he knew that we knew. It was a clue, and I put it into the system immediately. I flagged it as something important. Maybe the weasel was using a wheelchair in Washington. And maybe we were suddenly one step ahead of him instead of two steps behind. On that note, I finally called it a night. At least I hoped the day was finally over.
Chapter 27.
Very early the following morning, the Weasel made his way through crowded and noisy Union Station in a black collapsible wheelchair, and he was thinking mostly happy thoughts. He liked to win, and he was winning at every twist and turn. Jeffrey Schaefer had very good military contacts in Washington, D.C., which made him extremely valuable to the operation. He had contacts in London, too, one of the other target cities, but that wasn't as important to the Wolf. Still, he was a player again, and he liked the feeling of being somebody. Besides, he wanted to hurt a lot of people in America. He despised Americans. The Wolf had given him an opportunity to do some real damage here. Zamochit. The breaking of bones. Mass murder. Lately, Schaefer had been wearing his hair cut short, and he'd also dyed it black. He couldn't exactly disguise the fact that he was 6'2", but he had done something better. Actually, he'd gotten this idea from an old associate. During daylight, at least, he traveled around Washington in the wheelchair, a state-of-the-art model he could easily throw in the back of the Saab station wagon he was driving. If he was noticed occasionally, and he was, it was for all the wrong reasons. At 6:20 that morning, Schaefer met with a contact inside Union Station. They both got on cue, the contact standing behind Schaefer at a Starbucks. They struck up what appeared to be a casual conversation. "They're on the move," said the contact, who worked as an assistant to a higher-up in the FBI. Nobody listened to the warnings not to investigate. "They've already moved surveillance into the targeted cities. They're looking for you here, of course. Agent Cross is assigned to you." "I wouldn't have it any other way," Schaefer said, and smiled crookedly as he always did. He wasn't surprised about the surveillance. The Wolf had predicted it. So had he. He stayed in line and bought a latte. Then he pressed a button and the wheelchair rolled to a row of payphones near the railway station's ticket booths. He sipped his hot drink as he placed a local call. "I have some scat work for you. Pays very well," he said to the woman who answered. $50,000 for just an hour or so of your time."
"Well then, I'm your scut," said the woman, who happened to be one of the world's very best snipers.
Chapter 28.
The meeting with the subcontractor took place just before noon in the food court at the Tyson's Corner Mall. Colonel Schaefer met Captain Nicole Williams at a small table directly across from a Burger King. They had burgers and sodas laid out in front of them, but neither ate what Schaefer referred to as god-awful Yankee artery cloggers. "Nice wheels," Captain Williams said with a smirk when she saw him arrive in the wheelchair. "You have no shame, do you?" "Whatever works, Nicky," he returned her smile. "You know me well enough by now. Whatever the job takes, I get it done." "Yeah, I know you, Colonel. Anyway, thanks for thinking of me for this." "Wait until you hear about the job before you thank me," he said. "That's why I'm here, to listen." Actually, Schaefer was already a little concerned. He was surprised that Nicky Williams had let herself go so much since the last time they'd worked together. He doubted that she was 5'6", but she must have weighed close to 200 pounds now. Still, Nicky Williams exuded the confidence of the highly skilled professional Schaefer knew she had always been. They'd worked together for 6 months in Angola, and Captain Williams was very good at her specialty. She'd always delivered what was asked of her before. He told Nicky Williams only her part of the job and repeated the fee, which was $50,000 for less than an hour's work. The thing he liked best about Nicky was that she never complained about the difficulty of any job or even its risks. "What's the next step for me? When do we go?" were her only two questions after he had detailed the basics, though not the actual target. "Tomorrow at 1, you'll be at Manassas Regional Airport in Virginia. An MD-530 helicopter will set down there at 5 past the hour. We'll have an HK-PSG-1 on board for you." Williams frowned and shook her head. "Uh-uh. If you don't mind, I'll bring my own. I prefer the Winchester M70 with 300 Win Magnum hollow point boat tails. I field tested them, know they're best for this kind of job. You said that glass has to be penetrated, right?" "Yes, that's right, Captain. You have to shoot into an office building." Schaefer didn't object to the change in weapons. He had worked with plenty of snipers and knew they were always idiosyncratic, had their own peculiar way of doing things. He'd expected modifications from her and was surprised there weren't more, actually. "So, who's going to die tomorrow?" Nicky Williams finally asked. "I need to know that, of course." Schaefer told Captain Williams the target, and to her credit, she never raised an eyebrow. Her only reaction was, "My price just went up. It just doubled." Schaefer nodded slowly. "Agreed. That will be just fine, Captain." Then Nicky Williams smiled. "Did I settle too low?" Schaefer nodded again. "Yes, you did. But I'm going to give you $150 anyway. Just don't miss him."
Chapter 29. Chapter 29. We might have gotten a decent break in the case. Finally, something. And it had started with a tip from me. The wheelchair. We had a lead. At 10 in the morning, I raced across Washington to the Farragut apartment building on Cathedral Avenue. 3 years before, a partner of mine named Patsy Hampton had been murdered in the underground garage of the Farragut. Jeffrey Schaefer had killed her. The Farragut was where his old therapist lived. We'd had Dr. Elizabeth Cassidy under surveillance for the past 36 hours, and it seemed to have paid off. The weasel had shown up. He parked in the underground garage near where Patsy had been brutally killed. Then he went upstairs to the penthouse apartment, 10D, where Dr. Cassidy still lived. He'd come in a wheelchair. I boarded an elevator with four other agents. We had our guns drawn and ready. "He's extremely dangerous. Please take what I'm saying seriously," I reminded them as we stepped from the elevator on the therapist's floor. It had been painted since the last time I was there. So much of this was familiar, hauntingly so. I was getting angry all over again about Patsy Hampton's death, about the weasel. I pressed the bell at 10D. Then I called out, "FBI, open the door. FBI, Dr. Cassidy." The door opened and I was staring at a tall, attractive blonde woman whom I recognized. Elizabeth Cassidy recognized me, too. "Dr. Cross," she said. "What a surprise. Well, no, it isn't really." As she spoke, I heard a wheelchair rolling up behind her. I raised my gun, pushing Dr. Cassidy out of the way. I aimed my weapon. "Stop right there!" "Stop!" I shouted. The wheelchair and the man seated in it came into full view. I shook my head and slowly lowered the gun. I held back a curse. I smelled a rat, or should I say a weasel. The man in the wheelchair spoke.
"I'm obviously not Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer, nor have I met him. I'm a stage actor named Francis Niccolo, and I am physically impaired, so no rough treatment, please. I was told to come here, and I am being paid handsomely to do so. I was instructed to tell you that the Colonel says hello, and that you should have listened to the explicit instructions you were given. Since you are here, you didn't listen."
The man in the wheelchair then bowed from the waist.
"That's my part, my piece. It's all I know. How is my performance? Acceptable? You may applaud, if you wish."
"You're under arrest," I told him. Then I turned to Elizabeth Cassidy. "So are you. Where is he? Where's Schaefer?" She shook her head and looked incredibly sad. "I haven't seen Jeffrey in years. I'm being used, and so are you. Of course, for me, it's harder. I loved him. I strongly suggest that you get used to it. This is how his mind works, and I should know." So should I was thinking. So should I.
Chapter 30.
"This is impressive," thought Captain Nicky Williams. "Not the airfield meeting itself. The whole plan was dazzling. Audacious." Manassas Regional was a small, nondescript airport spread over 800 acres with two parallel runways. There was a main terminal building and an FAA control tower, but it was a very good spot for the mission. "Somebody is really thinking things through. This is going to work." A couple of minutes after Captain Williams arrived at the airfield, she saw her helicopter setting down. She had two instant notions. Where the hell had these people gotten an MD-530? And it was just right for the job she'd been given. This was definitely going to work. It might not even be that hairy. Nicky Williams hurried to the helicopter, carrying the Winchester Magnum in a cloth sling bag. The pilot had the other critical puzzle pieces for her. He was apparently the man with the final plan. I'm all fueled. We're headed northeast over Route 28. I'm going to set her down for half a minute or so in Rock Creek Park, he told her.
Rock Creek Park?
I don't follow, Captain Williams said. Why would you put down again once we're airborne? The park stop is just to get you up on the skid. That's your position for the hit. All right with you?
Perfect, Williams said. I get it now.
The scheme was daring, but it made sense to her. Everything about it did. They had even picked an overcast day with very slight winds. The MD-530 was fast and highly maneuverable. It was also stable enough to shoot from. In her army days, she'd fired thousands of rounds from them in all kinds of weather, and practice made perfect.
You ready? The pilot called back once she was on board. We're going to be in and out of D.C. in less than 9 minutes.
Williams gave it a thumbs up, and the MD-530 corkscrewed up fast, flew northeast, and was soon crossing the Potomac. It never got higher than 30 or 40 feet off the ground and was traveling at about 80 knots. The helicopter set down for less than 40 seconds in Rock Creek Park. Captain Williams took a position on the right skid, behind and just below the pilot. Then she signaled for him to lift off.
Let's go. Let's do it.
Not only is this smart, it is cool as hell, she couldn't help thinking as the helicopter took off again and closed on her target. In and out of harm's way in less than 9 minutes. He'll never know what hit him.
Chapter 31. I was back at my desk before noon, feeling edgy and ragged, tapping into the National Crime Information Center computer database, drinking about a gallon of black coffee, which was the worst thing to do. The goddamn weasel. He knew we had found out about the wheelchair. But how? They have somebody inside, don't they? Somebody warned Schaefer. At about 1, I was still at my desk when a shrill, ear-splitting alarm sounded in the building. At the same time, my pager signaled a terrorist alert. I heard loud voices up and down the hall. Look out your window! Go to your window, quick! Oh, good God, what the hell are they doing down there? Somebody else yelled. I took a look outside and was stunned to see 2 men in fatigues running across the pink granite cobblestone of the inner courtyard. They were just passing the bronze sculpture, Fidelity, Bravery, Integrity. My first wild thought was that the men might be human bombs. How else could just 2 of them hope to damage the building, or anybody inside? An agent named Charlie Kilvert from next door peeked his head inside. You catching this, Alex? You believe it? I see it. I don't believe it. I couldn't take my eyes off the action down in the courtyard, though. Within seconds, heavily armed agents had appeared on the scene. At first, there were only 3. Then at least 12. The guards from the sidewalk booth suddenly came tearing up the driveway, too. All the agents below had their guns pointed at the 2 men in fatigues. Both of them had stopped running now. They appeared to be surrendering. The agents weren't coming any closer, though. Maybe they shared my idea about human bombs, but more likely they were following procedure. The suspects were holding their arms high over their head. Then, slowly and deliberately, they lay flat on their stomach. What the hell? Then I spotted a helicopter drift around the south side of the Hoover Building. Just about all I could see was the nose and rotor. The ominous hovering of the copter caused the agents in the courtyard to aim their weapons into the sky. This was a no-fly zone, after all. The agents on the ground were yelling and threatening with their guns. Then the helicopter banked sharply away from the Hoover Building. It disappeared from sight. Seconds later, Charlie Kilvert was in the doorway again. Somebody's been shot upstairs! I almost knocked Charlie over getting out the door.
Chapter
Chapter 32.
The MD-530 was really moving as it got to Washington. The pilot was using office and apartment buildings for cover now, sliding between them like somebody playing the craziest game of hide-and-seek. The flying tactics would avoid radar detectors and also confuse the hell out of casual observers, Nicky Williams figured. Besides, this was all happening incredibly fast. No one would be able to react, and an Air Force jet wouldn't fly in this close to these office buildings anyway. She could see the target now. Hot damn. The disturbance on the ground had been planned, and lots of people were at their windows at the target building, which she knew was FBI headquarters. This is really something. She loved it. She had seen some major league action in the Army, but not enough of it, and there were always 1,000 rules you were supposed to follow. Only one rule now, baby. Shoot this guy dead and get the hell out of Dodge before anybody can do a goddamn thing about it. The pilot had the coordinates of the targeted window, and sure enough, two men in dark suits were standing there, looking down on the street action, the diversion built into the plan. Captain Williams knew what her target looked like, and by the time he saw her rifle only 100 feet away, he'd be dead, and she'd be on